Hot Air is a co-production of American University Washington College of Law and the American Bar Association. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Joining us for the second panel. I'll go into a little bit more detail on what the discussion will entail. First, I would just like to introduce Professor Snape, who is a fellow and practitioner in residence at American University Washington College of Law, as well as the Director of Adjunct Faculty Development. He previously was Chief Counsel to Defenders of Wildlife, and he currently is Senior Counsel with the Center for Biological Diversity, where he works on endangered species, public lands, and energy issues. Professor Snape is co-producer of The Hot Air Show, a podcast on climate change policy and regulation. Professor Snape has been practicing environmental law as an advocate for over 20 years. And so now I'll just review what the panel discussion will entail and who is joining us today. So panel two will be centered on challenges encountered domestically and internationally in pursuit of sustainable energy solutions. We realize this is a very broad topic that was by design because we would like to encourage a lot of variety of conversation about different energy access issues, both domestically and internationally, and that can range from anywhere from energy access to energy solutions, sustainable energy solutions, and also possibly the financial ways in which we are making those sustainable energy solutions possible. So without further ado, our speakers who have joined us today include Tom Swanson from Pew Charitable, Scott Lyons from USAID, Jennifer Rohleder, who is a private practice practitioner and has her own firm, and Mia Warner from Corporate Counsel on Africa. Unfortunately, Sheila Hollis had to, she had a conflict last minute, so she has promised a paper that we will distribute at a later date. So thank you very much, and I guess we have Tom Swanson going first.
Let me just say a few quick things. Thank you so much. Because I am moderating this panel, but I'm not moderating this panel. Erica Lennon will tag team with me about halfway through this panel by design as well. And I just wanted to point out that as you listen to these creative solutions or these solutions that are maybe a little bit outside of the box of what Joe Goffman talked about and what our first panel talked about, that in many ways these solutions do relate to what was talked about this morning. I mean, obviously, we didn't talk a lot about international issues this morning. You're going to hear about that this afternoon. We didn't really hear too much about a private practice perspective on how these rules could actually really work. I think you're going to hear some hints of that from Jennifer. So we're really starting to get at some solutions here in this second panel, and I'm very excited by that. Sheila Hollis was very apologetic. She couldn't make it. Her two-page, one side of two sides piece paper, one page is worth the read. It is has got many references to pop culture, and she asked some very provocative questions. So she is absolutely here in spirit, even though she couldn't be here in person. And lastly, this is a hot air podcast. We are taping right now, so you're part of a live radio show. And with that, we will send it over to Tom.
Thank you, Bill. So my name is Tom Swanson. I'm a manager with the Clean Energy Initiative with the Pew Charitable Trusts. Let me see if I got the clicker here. So just a quick background on the program. The Clean Energy Initiative really focuses on advancing federal policy that promotes the transition to a clean energy economy for its economic, security, and environmental benefits. We really promote policies in the four sectors that you see here. We want to increase efficiency in the industrial, utility, and transportation sectors, as well well as protect the research and development budgets for clean energy. We, as part of our program, we've undertaken a series of economic research to really look at the opportunities that the clean energy economy provides, not just to the United States, but globally. We produced our first report back in 2009 that really looked at clean energy jobs in all 50 states. But more recently, we've been looking at the G20 countries and how each of them are doing and stacking up against each other in terms of attracting clean energy investment, in terms of clean energy deployment. And so this is part of a series of reports called Who's Winning the Clean Energy Race. We released this earlier this year. This is the fifth edition, so we've seen some interesting trends. I'm going to try to keep my remarks here fairly brief so that I can just give you the top-line findings and then allow plenty of time for questions after the initial presentations. So some of the major takeaways from 2013, emerging markets was a theme that we saw. We saw investment move from the West, so places like Europe and America, where traditionally investment and deployment have been the strongest, to the West. So countries like China, Japan, new developing countries that don't have existing energy infrastructures are really looking at clean energy. So they have been very effective in deploying and attracting that investment. Europe, with the market crash there and some policies being removed that incentivize clean energy, has definitely taken a hit. Across the board, we see solar as really the emerging clean energy technology. It's kind of surpassed wind. I'll get into that in a little bit more details in a minute. We've also seen new private capital be able to be accessed for the first time. New third-party financing mechanisms, the cost of these technologies is also coming down. So these are all contributing to increased deployment. And kind of our overarching message that we've seen throughout all the research we've done is the importance of policy certainty. Those countries that have stable, long-term policy signals attract that investment. We see the deployment. Countries like the U.S., who have had somewhat of an episodic policy environment, we've seen the investment dip up and down quite a bit. So this is just a depiction of kind of the global investment numbers. You'll see over the last 2 years that they've dipped down a little bit. This isn't necessarily a bad thing. The cost of solar has come down dramatically. So the financing that's needed to get these projects, particularly utility-grade projects, off the ground is much lower. So this isn't really impacting deployment, but we do see that, you know, where policies have gone away, investment has shrunk a little bit. And the little yellow tab there, those are non-G20 countries, and you can see since 2011 that's growing a little bit. So that when I was referencing emerging markets, that's particularly where we're seeing it with developing countries. Again, investments moving west to east. Investments were down 42% from 2012 to 2013 in Europe. And what we see, again, are the Asia and Oceania investments have increased every year beginning from 2007 and have actually surpassed the European markets over the last year. So I think we're going to continue to see that trend moving forward. In terms of the overall deployment of clean energy, wind is still the biggest player, 307 gigawatts worldwide. But solar added 40 gigawatts last year, so that was almost a third of the total amount of solar that exists in the world. So you can see just even in the last year that solar is really taking off. I think we'll continue to see that trend. And these other technologies are emerging as well. And as the costs come down, deployment will certainly continue to increase. Wind was down 44% in terms of investment in 2013 versus 2012. A lot of that has to do with the production tax credit, which is a credit that wind manufacturers can use to develop projects. That credit has not been renewed here in the U.S., and we've seen investors get a little shaky about making a long-term commitment to these projects if they don't think that policy environment is going to be there to support them. China is the leader. They have really surpassed the United States in terms of attracting investment, $54 billion last year. Deployment, they're surging ahead as well. Even though their investment numbers were down slightly, the sheer size of their markets and their manufacturing that they're contributing to the clean energy economy is really a big player. U.S. is second. We've seen the U.S. go from first to third over the last three three or four years, and a lot of it does specifically relate to the policy environment in the U.S. not necessarily having that long-term signal, but still obviously this is the second largest market. And Japan is pretty interesting. That yellow bar there, that represents all solar, and they, of all the countries last year, deployed the most solar and attracted the most investment into solar projects. So a lot of this is somewhat in reaction to the Fukushima disaster. They've been looking for new energy sources that are cleaner and they're able to diversify with. So solar has been a major commitment, and you can see how that is paying off. So I just mentioned Japan. In terms of their annual growth rate, they increased the most from 2012 to 2013. The U.S., you can see, is sixth there. I mean, most countries' investments were down. The global economy was down. But again, policies have played a pretty big role in that. But I think more broadly, what we're seeing is this is really, the sector has emerged. I don't think it's no longer emerging. It has emerged, and it's going to continue to grow. It's $250 billion last year. You know, as the prices come down on these technologies, we're going to see increased deployment. You know, hopefully the investment numbers will continue to keep up, but that's kind of the trajectory it's going. New sources of capital have definitely been a key play to this, so more innovative financing mechanisms. There's things called real estate investment trusts, master limited partnerships. These are things that Congress is considering extending to renewable energy technologies. So if we see those, I think we'll see increased deployment and investment as more folks have access. And then, again, the long-term policy certainty is really a key. Those countries, again, that have set those signals are the ones that are really surging ahead, and the ones that have either repealed or there's been some episodic up and down, they've languished a little bit. And just as an example of this, and I'll wrap up with these last two slides, this is a forecast from Bloomberg New Energy Finance. They're our research partner for their G20 reports. What you see here from 2016 to 2020 is the projected amount of deployment for wind technology. This is based on a production tax credit that we don't know whether it's going to be extended this year. As you can see, there's a pretty significant dip off from 2015, which is the last year currently that manufacturers could take advantage of that credit. But if you extended that credit to 2020, you see quite a big uptick in terms of the amount of gigawatts that would be added. So I think it just demonstrates that, you know, that policy signal is so important. And, you know, that's kind of what our research has underscored consistently. So I'll hold for any questions after the rest of the presentations.
If it's okay with everyone, I'm gonna sit here. If that's so, quickly about myself, update. So I was with USAID. I'm no longer with USAID, and I'm about to be with USAID again in a couple weeks. It's the nature of federal government and changing of mechanisms and things like that. The good thing is I don't have to give any disclaimers, and I can say whatever I want for this very short period of time, which is nice. But I also want to make sure that I'm not identified right now as speaking on behalf of USAID or with USAID. So quickly about myself and my perspective on all of this. I spent the last 4 years as an anti-corruption advisor for USAID, working in crisis and conflict countries, especially in Africa. And I'm about to go back in as the democracy and governance officer for Sudan and South Sudan. So I've been, especially with Sudan, South Sudan, working with traditional fossil fuel resource issues, but I've spent a lot of time in countries in Africa working on considerable more sustainable energy issues. So that's kind of the background about myself. And looking at this issue of the challenges encountered in this, I come at it from a corruption perspective, just like a carpenter who, you know, sees everything with a hammer and a nail. I see everything or a lot of things in a corruption issue. And so when I was in Ghana a handful of years ago, helping develop the anti-corruption strategy there, there was an oil discovery, and the Ghanaian government officials rejoiced. There was great excitement, you know, all this new revenue that was, you know, predicting to be coming in, and many of the donors there, including myself. myself tended towards a more crasser form of "oh darn," our reaction was probably a little bit more concerned and some people more expletive filled. And the reason why is, you know, this is not because we were necessarily anti-fossil fuels, but because there's a well-known long history, especially in Africa, of being a resource curse. Countries with bad institutions suffer a resource curse, while those with strong institutions do not. There's obviously a difference in the impact of natural resources and from how it's happened in Norway versus how it's happened in Nigeria. There's a difference in how things have played out in the US with our recent discoveries versus Equatorial Guinea. And these differences are not accidental. The resource curse, there's real reasons for it, and the relationship of poor institutions and corruption and resources is real. The problem is all those same concerns unfortunately apply with the new massive investment in sustainable energy. Sustainable energy is great. There's huge benefits, which I'm going to talk about with climate change and things like that, economic growth, things like that. But when we're talking about the challenges and concerns, it would be remiss if we did not address the potential of resource curse emerging from that. So I was asked to specifically talk about or begin with the president's climate plan. So the president's climate plan commits to, quote, lead international efforts, the U.S. is going to lead international efforts to combat global climate change, with the sub-element to expand clean energy use. Great. That's wonderful. And how is this going to happen? Through financing and regulatory support for renewable and clean energy projects and actions that promote fuel switches from oil and coal to natural gas and renewables. Again, great. But now, so how is this starting to play out? And so most of the stuff is going to be great stuff, but listen to the numbers and also in follow-up of what was said before, the large numbers that are being thrown around, these are all billions with a B, which ties into it. So there was unlocked $1.6 billion in clean energy financing through the U.S. Africa Clean Energy Finance Initiative. There was $6 billion in export credits and government finance for clean energy development in Asia Pacific. There's more applications like $100 million in private fund partnerships in India. There's the Africa Infrastructure Program, AIP, which helped assist the purchase for the 300-megawatt Lake Turkana wind project, which if you're familiar with or if you haven't heard about it, is the largest wind project in Africa. It's massive. And then most notable in all of this, if you haven't heard about this, is Power Africa. This major, major initiative to add 10,000 megawatts of cleaner, more efficient generation in sub-Saharan Africa through $7 billion of USG investment. This has led to some great things, like the 1,000-megawatt geothermal plant in Ethiopia. I'm a big proponent of Power Africa. And the big concern, of course, is coming in is these are big dollars being invested. And as I mentioned before, there's a potential resource curse in the sustainable energy sector, just like there is in any traditional resource sector. Because anytime you have a heavy influx of public dollars, and especially in investment in electricity and energy sectors, it can lead to both grand and petty corruption and rent seeking. Rent seeking, for those of you who are not familiar, I'm going to read kind of a definition for you because not everyone's familiar with the term. It's when a company, organization, or individual uses their resources to obtain an economic gain from others without reciprocating any benefits back to the society through wealth creation. So basically, it's not corruption per se, but it's basically the looting and gaining of the economic benefits to one person who's doing all the generation without the society necessarily benefiting as whole. And the nature and what creates the resource curse is when there's weak institutions and weak governance, any influx of money on energy policies can have a negative effect. And this includes even if from the more liberal market-based side, if you have efficient market environments, you still have the same problems. So the concern is that countries with abundant renewable resources are more susceptible to exploitation of public incentives. Criminal activity follows the money sources. I'm an adjunct professor at the Uniformed Services University, and I teach corruption in healthcare. And it's really interesting to see all these criminal gangs have moved into fake pharmaceuticals instead of traditional narcotics because that's where the money is. There's more money in fake malaria pills than there is in heroin trafficking, and it's not as dangerous. So people follow the money. And corruption and organized crime is entrepreneurial, and they will follow the economic opportunities. And the stuff that's resulted from this is not stuff that you can make up. For example, so in Italy, especially with their guaranteed high prices for renewable wind energy, it's created incentives for the mafia to move in. The mafia has effectively gained large control of the wind farm production in Italy. The headlines in some of the busts have been amazing through wiretaps and things like that because it's highly lucrative. If you're interested, Telegraph has a whole bunch of exposés on this. Basically, it's massive corruption and bribes in building wind farms. And the reason why renewable energies and sustainable energy is especially susceptible is because anytime you have criminal activity at a time, you have the institutions that are not in place, and you also have absorptive capacity issues. Most of the countries, the U.S. can handle investment billions of dollars. A lot of countries cannot. So, for example, Haiti had a massive earthquake. Everyone said, "That's great. Let's rebuild Haiti." All the donors got together and put together, I think it was $11 billion. Haiti cannot absorb $11 billion of investment at one time. Just can't. The money's going to leak out. And when you start talking about countries in Africa, Southeast Asia, stuff like that, smaller economy countries, the massive amount of investment coming in that you just can't handle. Energy is particularly ripe or opportunistic for corruption for a couple of reasons. One, there's public procurement concerns. It's massive public procurement. You're building something on a huge scale. It's extensive, complex licensing and permits. That's a huge opportunity for bribes because every permit you have to get is an opportunity for a bribe. It's heavily regulatory. Also opportunities for bribes and corruption. There's a high guaranteed return on investment, usually price fixed, guaranteed by the government, highly lucrative for criminal activity to get into. There's complex projects with asymmetrical information. A lot of government officials don't really understand how a lot of this energy production works. There's opaque and complicated financing because it has to be project financing through various banks and various combinations, and it's capital intensive. So it's not accidental that energy and then, of course, renewable energies is going to be a target for corruption. And this is true whether the investment is lump sum transfers or tradable certificates or takes place in any other form. The return on investment basically guarantees perverse incentives for corruption. Unfortunately, this is not going to be an optimistic speech, if that wasn't clear. So the corruption occurs at the power development planning stage, decisions about demand, and actual project implementation. There was an interesting article, the Dutch head of the Kenya Lake Turkana project basically said that the only reason Kenya has enormous amounts of problems with corruption, and the reason why he said he was able to get around all of that and not have to pay all these bribes and all those things is at the time they came up with the project, this was new to Africa and East Africa, and the government officials had no idea it was going to be so lucrative, and they just weren't aware that there was going to be so many opportunities for bribes and corruption. And so he was able to kind of get it through before everyone was savvy to it. And also they were building the wind farms way out in the middle of nowhere in an area that just people weren't following. But that doesn't mean future projects, as the billions of dollars increase, won't be susceptible to these kinds of problems. So The clean energy schemes are lining, unfortunately, criminal pockets all over, especially South and Southeastern Europe, which has had a massive investiture in clean energy. This involves windmills that are derelict or never built. Some clean energy is even being used to launder money. Criminal enterprises are buying clean energy production and then selling it on, and they're using it to legitimate businesses, and they're using that way to clean their finances. All this is enabled by 5 billion euros a year in loans and grants for clean energy. Again, massive money flowing in creates the opportunistic environment, and a requirement that all EU nations must have 1/5 of their energy renewables be renewable by 2020. So you have forced investment in this of large dollars in countries that can't absorb and don't have the institutions and governance and rule of law and things like that to prevent corruption. They wiretapped a mafia don in Sicily, and this is one of my favorite quotes I read about this, and his quote that was captured was him saying, "Not one turbine will be built in Manzara," which is a region, "unless I agree to it." So basically, the wind turbines are like the ports and the garbage hauling and things like that. It's become an avenue for mafia control. And this criminality and corruption has been found in issues in Spain, Romania, Bulgaria, Corsica, Canary Islands, Albania, Croatia, etc. In Albania, key land was purchased by the daughter of the prime minister right before it was chosen for a clean energy project. Yeah, so, you know, I mean, this thing is going on. Separately, the deputy prime minister was recorded trying to corrupt a hydroelectric project. These are big dollars, big investiture. You know, these are projects in the hundreds of millions, with all the permitting, regulatory approval, things like that, that are needed. And in Croatia, the former prime minister was actually convicted for taking energy-related bribes. In China, just recently, the head of the renewable energy department was just sacked in May for corruption. So this is one of the massive challenges that is going to face this issue. So what are the solutions? Obviously, in pairing with the investment in renewable energy, there needs to be a heavy focus on governance and institution strengthening. This includes everything involving strengthening the policies, the regulatory environment, the licensing, everything that manages this kind of massive development that's going to go on in a short period of time. USAID and the Millennium Challenge Corporation are focusing on this. Since I'm now separate from USAID for a brief period of time, I can say they're not focusing enough. And in some places, really kind of, I would say, you know, they really need to be doing a lot more. There needs to be a focus on transparency and procurement and concessions. You're talking about, you know, if you're building, you know, a wind farm for hundreds of millions of dollars, you're talking about massive, massive procurement. And there needs to be transparency in this. A couple things that USAID is doing well, I would say, and I would think these need to be expanded, are less things of big investment, but facilitation activities. So there's things like the Private Finance Advisory Network, which helps clean energy entrepreneurs secure private financing, and it basically goes out and identifies promising clean energy projects for mentoring in their business plans and growth strategy, but it's helping those on a much smaller scale. So this has led to $400 million in private financing operating independently, and some great projects. Like, there was $13 million for Uganda's Barefoot Power Project, which was distributing solar lighting in certain parts of Uganda. Great, so the U.S. government is playing a facilitation role and helping connect private investment with the good ideas instead of putting in huge amounts of government dollars. Another good thing is the Grand Challenge for Agriculture. USAID's been doing these grand challenges. Basically, people come up and submit ideas, and it's almost like seed financing for all kinds of energy solutions related to agriculture. So these are kind of smaller bore, but really interesting ideas of things, as opposed to the top-down public investiture, which has more opportunities for corruption. I would also say, from the legal side, the Energy Security Through Transparency Act of Dodd-Frank 1504, which many of you are familiar with or may know as the Cardin-Lugar Amendment, deals with extractive industries and, you know, publishing payments where they operate. I would, if I had my druthers, say it would be great to expand that to investment in renewable energy so that companies that are investing, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in geothermal plants, wind farms, things like that, also need to declare what they've paid in terms of taxes, royalties, fees, production entitlements, things like that. The same information transparency, you know, they say sunshine is the best disinfectant. The more transparency that you have when it comes to procurement on the renewable energies, the better. And hopefully that will overcome some of the large challenges with renewable energy investment. Thank you.
Thanks, Jackie. So, hi, my name is Jennifer Rolletter, and as was mentioned, I do have my own practice, J. Rolletter Law. And so what I've been focusing on in that over the last year is really working with energy and environmental technology companies. Previously, I guess the easiest way to understand my background is that I'm a recovering engineer. I was an engineer before I went to law school. I'm a reformed consultant. I use my engineering and consulting. And now I'm a refugee from big law because, well, big law sucks, basically. And so so I started my own practice. But while I was still in the, you know, mid-sized to large law firm world, I was working with utility companies, transmission developers, renewable energy project developers, and the like. So I have a very different viewpoint, I think, than a lot of my colleagues here on the panel, where I take a very micro look at things. We've heard an awful lot of macro and how things are looking at a very high level, which is really important to understand the trends and where things are going. I really focus in on, okay, what does all of this mean for an energy or technology company, a project developer on the ground actually trying to deploy renewable energy or other sustainable technology. So it's I have a very different look at things. So I did a nice Google search, you know, at the beginning of my research for this, and it was like barriers to renewable energy technologies. And it came back, you know, with commercialization barriers, price distortions, failure of the market to value the public benefits of renewables, and market barriers like lack of capital, split incentives, and the like. And so it's a really great synopsis, and unfortunately, I didn't say it. The Union of Concerned Scientists said it back in 1999. So we have been talking about these same issues on what's keeping us from being able to get to more renewable energy, more sustainable development and energy. I mean, I'm sure since well before 1999, but the Union of Concerned Scientists encapsulated it for us here. What I would say is that regulatory policy dictates business models. And it sounds kind of provocative, but in my experience is absolutely true. Because what's at stake when you're talking about regulatory policy and business? The business value from government and regulatory intervention in the marketplace is estimated at 30% of the earnings of companies in most industries. And I would say energy, it's higher than that, you know, because they're talking banking and healthcare and, you know, all kinds of things. I would say energy is higher than that. Governments and regulators are second only to a company's customers as to what affects the economic value that that company is producing. Think about that. And all the things that can help, you know, shape what a company is doing and the economic value it derives, the government, almost more than its than the company's customers, is what's driving that. I find that crazy. So for an example, utility return on equity, ROE. So for an electric utility, ROE 101, utilities are entitled to charge a rate that permits them that permits the utility to cover its costs plus a reasonable rate of return. And for all you lawyers in the room, you can imagine the discussion and the litigation and the arbitration that goes on over what is a reasonable rate of return. Is it 5%, 6%? It's hovering somewhere around 10% right now at most state levels. So rate base and return on equity wrangling occurs both at the state and the federal levels. And it directly hits a utility's bottom line. This is what they are all focused on. And any activity that a utility is going to engage in, they're going to look at it through the lens of rate base and ROE, because that's where the money is. So an interesting thought case study is you have a small company, and they've developed a really great new grid appliance that will help utilities manage the integration of intermittent renewables onto their grid. It's a huge problem. The intermittency problem is huge. You got a lot of companies going after, trying to finesse that. But a utility is not going to buy anything, or at least not anything in any great quantity, that it cannot include in its rate base and its ROE. So unless that great new appliance that would enable all this solar and all this wind to get connected to the grid, unless a utility can buy that and put it in its rate base and put it through its ROE, they're not going to do it. They don't care. They have no incentive to do it because they're not going to be making money off of it. And so you have this company, they've perfected their technology, they've maybe bridged their commercialization barriers, maybe they have investment, they've done all these things, but they have zero market impact because they didn't necessarily understand how a utility does business. So understanding the regulatory environment that you're dealing with absolutely implicates or will increase the likelihood of commercial success. And policy stability that Tom talked about absolutely plays into that, because a small business in particular is going to have a really hard time keeping up with policy changes. And if it keeps going up and down and up and down and up and down, it makes for a lot of dead companies. So going back to the case study, if the company finds out, I've perfected my technology, but I can't get a utility to buy it because the state limitations, federal limitations on what can go into my rate base or what can go into my utility's rate base keeps me out, I have two options. I fail, right? Or I pivot. And I no longer try and sell my thing. I no longer try and sell the hardware to the utility. I become a manufacturer and an owner of these great little gizmos, and I go to the utility and I say, hey, utility, I will go out and I will install these on your lines, and it will enable the services that my thing will provide you, will enable you to connect, your whole solar interconnection backlog, like the one in Hawaii that's like 5,000 permits or something in their queue, something insane. It's going to allow you, Hawaii Electric Company, to interconnect all these people, no problem. But you don't have to buy my thing. You're just going to buy my monthly services. Well, all of a sudden, the utility is like, well, heck, I can buy services anytime I want because those are a direct flow through to my ratepayers. I can do that. However, that's a completely different business model for that small business. It's a completely different financial structure. It's a completely different capital investment scenario. It's completely different. And if that small business did not come to that business model and financial model early enough, regardless of whether they have the best technology in the market, that business will fail. It just will, from a lack of understanding of the regulatory environment. The term energy market has absolutely no practical meaning, at least in the US. I cannot say globally. But the geographic location and where you are in the United States absolutely dictates the energy scenario you're dealing with. When it comes to energy regulations related to renewables, the federal government in the U.S. is barely involved. DOE, you can ignore. Regardless of what their, the name of their agency, they're not involved. FERC, same thing. They're in wholesale transmission, wholesale power dealings. They're not that involved either. Aside from the financial incentive muddle that Congress and these various agencies have created, they're not involved from a small business perspective. There is no U.S. electricity market, state by state, service territory by service territory of individual utilities. That's what these companies are dealing with. And you've got all these different market variables. What, are you dealing with a regulated versus a deregulated state retail electricity market? Is your state and your utility in an RTO ISO, that's a regional transmission organization, for those not in the know? Does your state have a renewable portfolio standard or not? What are the interconnection policies with your individual utility and your individual state? Believe it or not, it varies by utility and by state, all of these things. Net metering policies, availability of third-party power purchase agreements, and property assessed clean energy financing. All of these things vary state by state. So I pulled this from the Desire website, database of state incentives for renewable energy, of renewables and efficiency. If you don't know about this site and you're interested in energy, go here because they're awesome. And evidently they're coming out with a new version of their website next month, which is cool. But so this is renewable portfolio standards. So in red, you see where they have one. In orange, you see where there's goals. You can see where they have minimum solar requirements. They've got extra credit for solar. Solar water heating may be eligible, may not be. You know, maybe it includes non-renewable alternative resources, or maybe the state does absolutely nothing with respect to an RPS. An individual small business that has a great new technology can't just say, I'm going to go sell it to the U.S., they got to sit down and isolate what markets make the most sense for them to start with in order to gain any traction. They have to go through an entire regulatory strategy situation in order to figure out where they can go sell their really great technology, assuming they've already proven it works. They've already, completed all of these other hurdles. You've got this great thing, and it could transform the world, but if you don't try selling it in the right state to start with, you run out of capital before you succeed, and then the company fails, and you got a, the next Betamax machine sitting on your shelf. So net metering, same thing. Any kind of company doing a play for behind the meter, they got to worry about all this. Third-party solar PV, power purchase agreements. Third-party financing is great. I've got a school, I got a company out there that wants to come and install solar on my school, and they'll sell me the power, and then, so they'll own it, they'll finance the investment to get it installed. I don't have to do anything. I just buy my power from them, and I buy my leftover from my existing utility company. Great, everybody wins, right? Except not every state allows that. And in some, it's expressly prohibited. So all kinds of creativity in financing and ways of obtaining market penetration and, doing this best case scenario for everybody doesn't work because the regulatory environment doesn't allow it. So how do you succeed and make an impact? Well, you could hire a good regulatory attorney, which I'm sure we would all advocate for, right? But it's understanding how the regulatory environment affects business that increases the likelihood of success. Everyone in this room is interested in seeing a world with more renewable, cleaner energy, right? A cleaner environment, a better quality of life for everyone globally. We all have vivid dreams of what this could look like and how we could get there, but ultimately, you need to know how the game is currently played and how you can make your business succeed within it. Because if you can build the better mousetrap and make it work in the existing regulatory environment, you can get the market to start moving to you. But you can't just assume that the world's going to pee to bath to your door just because you have the latest and greatest grid appliance that's going to let you integrate renewables, because structurally, the folks you're trying to sell it to might not be able to buy it from you. So I think it's important for both businesses to understand this. It's also really important for the policymakers to understand this, that we're not just talking about, you know, a few tax incentives here and there to try and increase adoption. That's like the least of our worries at this point. We should really stop talking about the financial incentives, because the smart companies, the smart technologists, are out there building things that are going to work in the market as it exists, and they don't need the incentives to do it. They're just going to do it. And if it makes business sense, everybody will do it. So that's all I got. End rant.
Thank you. Unlike my fellow panelists, I'm not a lawyer. My background is in economics and a bit of anti-corruption, so thank you for letting me through the door. As was mentioned, my name is Mia Warner, and I direct the energy program at the Corporate Council on Africa, so I'll start with a little bit of background on CCA. CCA is the key resource for conducting successful business in Africa. We work closely with governments, multilateral groups, and businesses to improve Africa's trade and investment climate and to raise the profile of Africa and the U.S. business community. CCA has over 180 member companies, some listed here, which represent nearly 85% of total U.S. private sector investment in Africa. CCA's members range from small to large and represent a whole range of industries. We provide members with greater access, connections, and insight for doing business between the U.S. and Africa through a number of events, trade missions, and advisory programs. In addition, CCA serves as a primary point of contact for the private sector for the Presidential Power Africa Initiative. Our energy program convenes a monthly working group for members to make new business contacts and discuss energy issues such as oil and gas, PPPs, funding sources, and renewable energy programs. For example, during the U.S.-Africa Leader Summit in August, we hosted the official Power Africa Luncheon, which featured energy ministers from Kenya, Nigeria, Cote d'Ivoire, and Liberia, in addition to executive speakers from GE and Contour Global, as featured here. I'm proud to announce we are also in the final stages of creating a Power Africa portal, which will answer questions investors often have about doing business in Africa and about the initiative itself. Plus, the site will feature a tenders portal and a database of potential partners. The portal will be available on our website by the end of next week. Please check our website for updates on the portal and about other CCA events. With that, let's move on to the challenges that CCA member companies are facing. Considering CCA has so many members, it's apparent that Africa holds many opportunities. The continent boasts enormous natural resources across the board. For example, almost 30% of global oil and gas discoveries made over the last 5 years have been in sub-Saharan Africa. However, a number of challenges hamper the energy industry and hinder the continent's growth. Many challenges that energy companies face on the continent are similar to those faced by companies wishing to do business in the industry, in any industry in Africa. Please keep in mind that these are broad generalizations. They are not true in every country on the continent, and many even present opportunities for investment. The first is poor infrastructure. If we look at the graph, we see that in most of the countries, over 50% of the population lacks access to electricity, which undermines efforts in these countries to achieve more rapid social and economic development. Beyond electricity, many African markets lack other developed forms of infrastructure, such as proper roads, rail networks, ports, and water systems, which are necessary to conduct international business. Next is local capacity. One of the top issues I hear from our member companies is that they can't fill all the jobs they have available in Africa because there aren't enough locals with proper technical training, and few local universities can provide sufficient skills. Many of our companies, like IBM, Exxon, and GE, have created their own technical training programs in-country to train local workers, but more is needed. Next is startup cost. Startup costs are expensive and can be an insurmountable challenge, particularly for small or medium enterprises that are looking to do business in this space. For example, social and environmental impact studies are expensive and financing can be difficult to access due to various requirements such as minimum U.S. content. The variety of financing options and institutions both within the U.S. government and internationally can be difficult to navigate. Initiatives like Power Africa and Trade Africa are doing much to tackle this, but there's a lot more work to be done. Lack of good governance leads to corruption, opaque procurement processes, and regulatory policy and currency uncertainty, all of which make it difficult to conduct business. In response, international companies must find a good local partner to help them navigate local politics and players. Another challenge common under governance is land rights. In many African countries, it's difficult to ascertain the true owner of a piece of land, which can make it difficult to start an energy project or can pose complications many years after the project is started. For example, a wind farm needs many acres of land, but the seller's copy of title might not be genuine, and the government title office might not have the original copy of the title. If you see the picture here, where it says this property is not for sale, that's common in a lot of African countries, and that sign goes up because somebody will come and try to buy the piece of land. Somebody will say, yes, I own it, but they don't actually own it, which can lead to frustrations, obviously. Lastly, security is a challenge and can add cost, time, and concern to projects. Depending on where the company is operating, security concerns can range from petty theft to terrorist attacks. In response to these challenges, the Obama administration launched the Power Africa initiative last summer. I'll expand on some of the details that Scott laid out. With the initiative, it's basically a commitment made by the president to work with various partners to add 30,000 megawatts of electricity generation and more than 60 million new household and business connections in sub-Saharan Africa. It was originally 10 megawatts and it was expanded to 10,000 megawatts and it was expanded to 30,000 this past summer at the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit. To meet these goals, the U.S. government has committed more than $7 billion in financial support, and Power Africa's financial partners have committed over $20 billion. As I mentioned earlier, CCA is one of the private sector partners, as are many of our members. One of the key tools of this initiative is that USAID has deployed transaction advisors to each of the focus countries, shown here in red on the map. These transaction advisors are working with U.S. companies and African government officials to help overcome barriers to investment and obstacles in project development. Some milestones announced so far include the partnership between the U.S. Africa Development Foundation and GE Africa and the Off-Grid Energy Challenge. This provides grants to African companies and organizations for off-grid solutions that deploy renewable resources and power local economic activities. So far, 28 awardees have received grants of $100,000 each. Another instance, Power Africa advisors helped Cummins finalize its agreement with Kenya Power for electricity production on a 12-megawatt biomass project. In my remaining time, I'll quickly touch on some other policies and standards. Considering more than 620 million people live without access to electricity in sub-Saharan Africa, and the fact that the president has essentially committed publicly to help provide power for at least half of those Africans who currently lack it, Power Africa sets noble and needed goals. Given this enormous goal, Africans will need to be able to make full use of all their natural resources. This raises tensions with global development goals, which rely primarily on renewable resources in an effort to meet climate standards. Looking at the current slide, we see that the International Energy Agency has predicted that Africa's renewable resource capacity will grow tremendously over the next 25 years. Yet, looking at the other graph, which is calculated by the Center for Global Development, we see that it's not possible to meet these targets through renewable resources alone. A blend of renewables and natural gas-fired power could provide energy access to millions more people. Moving on to the next slide, and I can distribute these through Kelly or through Jackie, where they're easier to see. These are through the Breakthrough Institute. They can also be found online. They have some great graphs. We see that U.S. domestic energy policies compared to U.S. support for low-income country energy generation to include support for Power Africa countries. There are two particular points that I would like to pull out of these graphs. They highlight constraints on international energy development in low-income countries. One is in the bottom graph, where you'll see that all of the Power Africa countries, including Nigeria, fall in the category of low-emitting energy-poor countries, meaning that they not only benefit very little from the advantages of regular and reliable energy generation, such as lighting and refrigeration, but they also contribute very little to global CO2 emissions. The second thing that I'd like to highlight is that the U.S. companies wanting to invest in some of the most efficient and effective energy solutions for Africa are hindered by U.S. policies that constrain the lending practices of OPIC and EXIM. These are the agencies that make up the bulk of the U.S. government's $7 billion commitment to Power Africa. Policy writers in the FY14 Omnibus Appropriations Bill temporarily allow EXIM and OPIC to engage in non-renewable power generation projects in some countries using local resources like natural gas and coal beyond the agency's existing carbon caps and policies. However, longer-term policy on these local resources remains under debate. Plus, the bill also banned U.S. support at the IFIs for any large hydro projects. Hydro is traditionally considered a renewable power source and one that many think is necessary for reliable electricity access in much of Africa. Beyond these constraints on the type of projects they can fund, OPIC and EXIM continually fight battles for reauthorization, which further limits the ability of the private sector to obtain reliable financing for projects in Africa. So with that, I'll stop. Further information on CCA and our programs and events can be found on our website. And as I mentioned, the Power Africa portal, which will have the tenders and a database of potential partners, will also be available on the site next week. I'm happy to answer questions.
As you can see, I am not Bill Snape, but I'm going to moderate the discussion portion of the panel, and I would rather hear from all of you than you guys probably want to hear from me. So I encourage you guys, and now we'll take questions, and if you could come up to, there are microphones at the end of the aisles, and say who you are and where you're from, or if you're a student, but yeah. I'm going to open it up to questions from the audience unless the panelists have questions for each other. Anyone? All right, audience. It's time for participation late in the afternoon.
Sure. That's a great question, and I do think, I mean, part of the reason we put this research out is to provide it to policymakers so they can kind of see, you know, that there are some opportunities that the U.S. is slipping on in particular, and you know, with a policy structure that was a little bit more friendlier to deployment and attracting investment, they might be doing a lot better. And Europe is a pretty interesting example because they had kind of across the board had these market challenges, and I think that has, you know, unfortunately caused them to look at, you know, renewable energy potentially as an area where, well, okay, well, we had this mandate, such as Germany, to put so much solar on the grid, and, well, you know, but that's going to require so much public investment. Do we really, you know, is that a priority based on some of the other economic challenges that come up? So I think, you know, it'll be interesting to see over the next couple of years if this trend continues, or maybe there's a little bit of a backlash. And I think, you know, in the U.S., as we look at the Clean Power Plan, you know, part of what we focus on is kind of the renewable energy side of the equation. So you can regulate the coal, the oil, coal, and gas folks, but you need a new energy source to really kind of pick up that demand as we, you know, get a decade or two down the road. So it'll be interesting to see. And as you mentioned, with Congress, you know, becoming Republican controlled in the House and Senate, will there be a lame duck session that this year that will look at the production tax credit, some of these other incentives that are on the table? We don't really know. Moving forward, Senator Inhofe is likely to become chairman of the Environment and Public Works Committee. That's going to be a big uphill battle for clean energy advocates as they look at EPA authority, as they look at Keystone, some of these other broader issues. So I think congressionally it's going to be a pretty challenging environment to make those advancements. But I think the administration has really said, okay, well, what can we do with executive authority? So you've seen the Clean Power Plan. They set a goal last year of getting 20% of renewables from their federal agencies by 2020. The Department of Defense actually has been one of the biggest leaders in the country. They've set goals of renewable deployment of 25% by 2025, and they're really on their route to reaching those. And they're not doing it for environmental reasons. It's national security, energy security reasons. So it'll be interesting to see if these other benefits that come from a transition to clean energy can kind of come to the forefront and provide more incentive for the U.S. and other countries to move forward. And obviously, you know, climate change, as that becomes a more important issue, I think that countries hopefully will take another look at that and see that there might be other values outside of an economic bottom line of why we want to really, you know, push towards that transition.
My question is for Scott. Perhaps Scott can tell us a little bit about some of the redressability mechanisms that can be put in place to minimize the impact of corruption, particularly in cases where access of information is limited. In most African countries, we will see an increase in participation of the private sector and less involvement of the government. I'm talking about public and private sector partnerships that are taking place. Very often, governments have policies that allow communities to somehow participate in the process, but there is also proprietary information involved throughout through every single step, and the private sector said, well, we won't get involved unless we actually feel protected when it comes to the type of investment that we are making. If any of you guys also can share your thoughts about it, that will be great. Thank you.
It's a good question, and it is challenging. There are, even when you have certain aspects of information that's proprietary that can't be revealed, a lot of the relevant information can be and should be available. There's one of the things you see in strong countries that have strong institutions is they have strong civil society and strong civil society involvement. And so, you know, active participation in terms of transparency and revealing information. In procurement, procurement tenders should be public information. What the government is trying to buy or procure, how much they're spending for it, what the information is. When you have procurement that's done hidden behind proprietary information in which you have sole bidders and things like that, that's possible. It's not always avenues for corruption, but it's reasons for concern. And so, you know, the best avenues is having that public information out there, and then having civil society monitor it. Except for reasons for national security, a lot of this energy information there should be easily available. There's no real strong argument for keeping it hidden. And a lot of the investment and development is when being done in one country, the models and things have been done in other countries. So it's not like this is something revolutionary that's going on in that one specific country where they're doing that type of energy development. So again, the models, there's no reason to hide the information. The big thing I would say, especially in Africa, is that civil society there needs to be pushing and demanding for the information to be open and revealed. And then, so the open information about the procurement, open information about the land that's purchased and who's purchasing it, that which was raised before, things like that. There's a lot of the campaigns, such as the Publish What You Pay campaign and things like that. Some of the principles from the EITI. All the things that are being used with extractive industries, as I said before, all apply here, just in the exact same ways, because you have that kind of large-scale investment by and seeing what company is getting to own it as being the monopoly and control it, especially since they are the sole owner in these projects, and it's not going to be market competitive necessarily afterwards. The more information before that's shared, the better. I hope that helps.
I was just going to say, you're definitely more of an expert on this than I am, but from my knowledge, a lot of times the procurement officer is not a very professional position. It's just thrown to somebody who has no experience in the role whatsoever. And I know that there's been a lot of advocacy within companies and somewhat on the part of Transparency International to professionalize the procurement role, and then even maybe to add some sort of factor within the World Bank Doing Business report on procurement, so that countries would pay a lot more attention to procurement and to professionalization of procurement, so that perhaps the procurement officer couldn't be bribed along the way to go one way or another, or even so the procurement officer would be paid better because lower paying officers can be influenced better, influenced more heavily. So I think that would be my main contribution.
My question is, I'm Anika Aka from Côte d'Ivoire. I'm an LLM student. My question is, what are the conditions to be part of Power Africa? Why I'm asking, because Côte d'Ivoire has the obligation to sell electricity to neighboring countries like Liberia or Ghana, but we cannot sustain our own electricity market. So what are the conditions, and we are not part of Power Africa, and those countries are part of Power Africa. So thank you.
That's so Jackie and I were talking about that before. That's one of the most commonly asked questions about Power Africa, and I've never heard a straight answer on the conditions about that. But the good news is that now all of Africa, as of August, the president announced that all of Africa is considered to be under Power Africa. Those six original countries are still considered to be the focus countries, but all of Africa is eligible for technical assistance. Every single country is eligible for this funding. They're all eligible for the transaction advisors, as far as I understand, are still based in those six countries, but they're going to take a more regional approach. So any U.S. company that wants to do business in Africa, and if they're encountering any sort of barrier, it doesn't matter if they're doing business in Cote d'Ivoire or in Kenya, they can still receive assistance. They can still receive funding from Ex-Im Bank or from USTDA for a feasibility study. It doesn't matter where they are. And that's part of the reason that we really push to have a non-Power Africa minister on our panel that we had back in August at the luncheon. The energy minister for Cote d'Ivoire was on that because we got so many inquiries, not just from the African countries themselves, but also from our companies, because they do business in all of the countries in Africa. They don't just do business in these six countries.
Yeah, to add to that, the U.S. government personnel who were put in these six countries, there was kind of original expectation that they were going to be regional applications for this. And also to know that USAID and U.S. government, for a wide variety of reasons, often pilots projects and programs in certain countries. And these are the same countries that are pilots. So, you know, Ghana, Tanzania, Ethiopia, so forth, are pilot countries in which programs are kind of launched, and to see how it works there before rolling it out to other countries. So it's not necessarily meant to exclude the remainder of Africa. It's more kind of that's where we often start.
And from that, I think the understanding is the last year the pilot program was so successful that they decided to expand it and make it a more regional focus.
Right. Yeah. No, it's a very good question. So I come at this from sort of a pragmatic environmentalist standpoint. And so from my perspective, if we want to see mass adoption or mass movement of the market from a fossil-driven energy system to a cleaner energy system, it's going to need to make sense in reality. That in the long term, government financial incentives, whether they be tax credits or, you know, that kind of thing, it helps a fledgling industry get up and running and, you know, survive long enough to emerge and mature. But I feel like in this country, we just keep getting caught on this same merry-go-round, and I personally work with a lot of energy entrepreneurs who are just like, okay, well, I don't even pay attention to any of that anymore, because it's like if I make something that makes business sense, then the market's going to want to adopt it. So I don't think I think government support of R&D is critical. So I would differentiate between supportive R&D and, you know, the production tax credit. I think that the DOE National Labs and the technology transfer mechanisms that they're trying to put in place to develop, to do pure science, pure R&D, and get it spun out into the private sector to commercialize, I think is also critically important. And that is one way that DOE does play a role, I think, in this whole thing. But I think sustainability works on many levels, and one of those things is making sure that you have a sustainable business around the successful technologies. That's how the market would choose the winners and losers, rather than government picking winners and losers, because it makes business sense. And it's going to make business sense because your customers are going to feel better about it because the air is cleaner and the water's cleaner and maybe it's cheaper. And, you know, ultimately, you know, whatever the value proposition of it makes sense. In my work, I'm finding that some of my entrepreneurs are looking abroad. You know, it's the U.S. is a vast country. From an electricity market standpoint, where federalism run amok, it's very balkanized. So it's, you know, a small company based in Virginia is looking at, you know, okay, I've proven my technology, I'm getting investors because they like my thing, they see the potential, but where does it make sense for me to go first? Where's my first bite at the apple to get it out there and start building it? And so then you have to do a 50-state survey and study to see, you know, okay, well, it makes sense for me to sell in California, Nevada, Illinois, and Connecticut, and I'm sitting in Virginia. You know, I mean, those are the issues that these companies are facing. And so it's not that they're limited, that they have a limited market in the U.S. It's that it's a very fragmented market in the U.S. And so some of the technology companies are looking abroad and are looking to take advantage of Power Africa, other USAID programs, other, you know, and doing joint ventures with large corporations like Nestle, you know, and partnering up. You know, it's like they've got water filtration technologies and other things that, because water and energy go hand in hand, and that's just gonna get more so as the climate changes. So I don't know if I've danced all the way around your question now or not, but if anyone else has any thoughts.
I'll just add on the innovation piece. I think that is essential. And what we've seen is where we have embraced innovation, that it really has helped driven the cost down. And we've looked at, I mentioned the Department of Defense earlier. They've been an early adopter of technologies since their existence, basically, whether it was, you know, GPS, the internet. They're doing the same with renewable energy technologies. So where you can have a potential buyer, they're really key in the commercialization process as well. But solar in a lot of places, even in this country, is cheaper than, you know, hooking up to the grid. But it is, you know, fragmented by state policies that are different. So I think, you know, some sort of, you know, federal or at least national policy that provides some sort of level of certainty and parity makes a lot of sense, so that, you know, these companies do have a market here and it's not just looking abroad. And so I think that was some really important points that our research has shown as well.
Is Jameson Toomey. I'm a 1L here. And I guess I have a couple questions. The first for Mr. Lyons. So I was wondering if you could expand a little bit. I think you mentioned a bit about just the general idea of anytime there are large outlays of funding, or there will be corruption may or probably will follow. And I was wondering if you could speak a little bit more about Power Africa, and in that, you know, we're seeing it's been very successful in stimulating just those kinds of large investments. But due to kind of the composition of the funding, I mean, in that the U.S. government, say, if they took an interest in wanting to clamp down on corruption, I mean, they'd have a limited ability to do so, given how the kind of funds are structured. So I guess I was wondering maybe if you could speak to, if they wanted to do more, what could they be doing? Or just generally, just anything you wanted to say on that idea. And then I may just say my second question first and then retreat. And a question from Ms. Warner as well, just about CCA. In terms of just its, I guess, organizational structure, in terms of kind of the organization's presence in Africa, in terms of gathering information about operating in a given country or region, and I guess how that works. Because I imagine a lot of your members would have substantial resources and would be able to gather some information on their own. At the same time, I feel like having an organization whose purpose it is to kind of have that overall knowledge of just how things go generally and who could you know, who might be good potential partners. I was wondering how that information is gathered and what kind of presence the CCA has ongoing, I guess, in Africa itself. So that's it.
No, it's a good question, and I would be concerned if the U.S. government was just giving money through Power Africa, which I kind of allude to in some form of Mia also, I think, mentioned this. They're doing a lot more than just giving money, and some of it is policy strengthening, some of it is technical advice, some of it is in some countries there needs to be legislative or regulatory changes. To enable the power development. And anytime you're strengthening the systems and institutions for it, you're reducing the opportunities. It's the famous not a power related idea, but if you've Hernando de Soto, there's a famous thing about permitting in Peru. And the idea that it basically enabled, or the system was geared to a way that people were going to work outside the system in a black market because the permitting was so difficult to register your business. The idea in Power Africa is if you're working within the system and making the system work better, then you're reducing the opportunities for it. There's huge amount of money going in, but I have to say also at the same time there's increasing safeguards accompanying the money that as over the last several years there's been more I think warranted criticism of U.S. government expenditures abroad and the accountability for it. Accompanying that is both increasing the systems to make sure there's not corruption and then also tracking how the money is spent. To make sure that there's not leakage for it, and I think there's being a good job being done on both those fronts, and I think that's helped Power Africa be more successful.
Multiple fronts. We have a full-time consultant in Ethiopia. We have one in Kenya, Nigeria. We're about to have one in Kenya, and then we have a part-time consultant in South Africa. Beyond that, 20% of CCA's members are actually African companies. Some of them are the biggest ones you've heard of, like Dangote Industries, Tony Alamelu's company, Aris Holdings, Transcentury, South African Airways, Ethiopian Airways, companies like that. Beyond that, I think one of the most important things is that a lot of our companies actually have a presence on the ground in Africa, whether it's just one employee to, 300 employees or even grander than that. And so a lot of the ways that our companies find partners or is either, from their presence on the ground and then they talk to people and they find things through that, or they talk to each other. The big benefit of CCA is the networking opportunities, and that comes, not just from having a happy hour to talk to people, but from coming to our events where people come and they learn about something, and then afterwards they hang around and they talk to each other, and they'll say, I want to do a feasibility study in West Africa. Who are you using? And they trust each other and they know each other, and so they talk to each other through that. And then one of the last things we do is trade missions, and those are one of the most important things because while people are on the ground, they not only get to meet the president, they get to meet ministers, but they travel with the same people for 10 days to 2 weeks, and they really get to know each other. They get to meet these people on the ground and get to know them, and they develop local partners that way. But I think the biggest thing is having a presence on the ground, because it's a two-way street, and the local partners aren't going to trust you if you're a fly-by-night organization and you're making 4 trips a year for a weekend. They're going to want to know that you're going to be there for the long haul.
Other questions from the floor before we wrap up this panel? I guess, yeah. Perfect.
Hi there, I'm Joseph Tibui, I'm from Cameroon in Central Africa. LLM alumni, Virginia attorney, an attorney in Cameroon as well. And I do deal with some development issues. I have a brief remark here, and then I have a question. The question of corruption in that part of the world, I believe, is systemic. And it's not going to be difficult to deal with. I don't want to spend any time talking about it. My issue here is the solutions, whether it is by, when we're talking about sustainable development or any other form of economic development. Here's what I see as a problem with the region, sub-Saharan Africa in particular, is that it's a society that's built on personalities. We have strong personalities and very little of strong institutions. And to that, I'm advocating having regional institutions would substantially overcome some of the corruption we have. There are regional economic development institutions, whether you're talking about companies, you're talking about banks, you're talking about, if you have regional institutions, they tend to hold down corruption. And this may I'm suggesting that this is an advice I'd offer USAID, since it somebody here from there. Having regional institutions that are able to follow some rules and regulations would deal with a lot of these problems. If you go out there and you're dealing with individuals, you'd never be able to overcome this problem. Again, whether you're talking about sustainable development, financial development, economic development, it's the same thing. The major regional institutions there, in different forms, rather than having a country representative, you should have somebody who deals with a region. There's a Central African region, it's a West African region, it's an East African region. And so when an official is dealing with any particular issue, they're just not looking at themselves or their countries. They're having to interact with others, and then would be less likely not to follow the rules that have been laid out, and that would be my suggestion. Do you have any questions?
Thank you for that recommendation. One of the things I forgot to mention is that we also work a lot with regional institutions, whether it's broadly like the EAC, COMESA, things like that, or regional business associations, and not all regions have, some regional associations and institutions are stronger than others. I think one of the strongest ones that we work with is the EAC and their business association, which is the East Africa Business Council. We can talk offline, and I'd love to get recommendations that you have for strengthening those institutions.
I think just one more thing before I leave it. In that, these regional institutions can bring much more pressure to bear on a particular individual or a particular country that's not following the rules. But if you're looking at any form of internal opposition, it simply is not going to work. But you can have outsiders, not simply just outside the region, but even outside the continent, that can bring pressure to bear on an individual, on a certain policy or so, and you have a greater ability to have some change there. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for that. I think we are basically at the closing time for this panel. Before we go, I want to say thank you to the panelists. I think we heard a lot that connected to the earlier panel about the Clean Power Plan and sort of what all the challenges are for in this world where we're trying to address climate change but also provide energy for people, both domestically and internationally and abroad and around the world. What the challenges are. And before we leave, and I'm going to ask the panelists to stay up here, I want to invite Kelly up to make closing remarks. And so she will do that before we end the day. Thank you, guys.
So I'd like to start by saying thank you to everyone for coming out today, whether it was to supplement your coursework, to network because your professor told you to, or because you were genuinely interested in today's topics. To recap today's events, we hosted speakers with experience ranging from commercial litigation firms, federal and local government entities, NGOs, nonprofits, and we also had some alumni speak and friends of the university. Today's discussions were dynamic, extensive, and thought-provoking. Here are some of the highlights. Discussion today covered how the 111D rule works and the goals it's designed to accomplish, nonprofits advocating for the use of different tools for addressing climate change issues, legal analyses of the rules and what the rule looks like from the judicial review standpoint, so limits enforced by the courts given the precedent, Clean Air Task Force comments that will be submitted on the rule, so we got a preview of what that will look like. Also, the DC approach to power production and distribution, and we learned about the Clean Power Plan goals from one of the rule's developers, straight from the mouth himself, so Joe Goffman. We also covered the Clean Energy Initiative, global clean energy investments and implications of the resource curse, Power Africa initiative, and a focus on the imperative role that business and the market can play in terms of developing sustainable technologies aside from tax credits. So SDLP's publication focuses on reconciling the tensions between environmental sustainability, economic development and human welfare. Our mission is to serve as a valuable resource for practitioners, policymakers, and concerned citizens promoting sustainable development throughout the world. We hope we accomplish this goal today during our symposium and as we continue to educate the general public and environmental and energy communities going forward about sustainable development strategies. So on behalf of the entire SDLP publication staff, executive board, and advisors, I'd like to give a big thanks to our speakers and moderators who offered insightful commentary, predictions, and detail on where the energy, clean energy is headed today and in the future. We'd also like to thank the audience and everyone who supported this event. Please give everyone and yourselves a round of applause at this time.